Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock right now on this day, 1923. Adolf Hitler would be arrested for attempting to seize power while a coup was taking place. We would obviously know that later on in his life, he would succeed in that endeavor. In 1927 on this day, Leon Trotsky would be expelled from the Soviet Communist Party, paving the way for Joseph Stalin to consolidate power in the party at the time. 1974 on this day, South Africa would be suspended from the UN General Assembly over racial policies. Good thing we worked that one out. 1979, the President of the United States at the time, President Carter, would halt Iranian oil imports as well as freeze Iranian assets. Suppose that's why people might be wanting to move away from the dollar. In 1989, Brazil would hold its first ever free presidential election in 29 years. In 1990, a CERN scientist by the name of Tim Berners-Lee would first propose the concept of the World Wide Web. 1995 on this day, Michael Schumacher would take second place in a, or would take his second title rather, driving for Benetton, defeating arch rival Damien Hill in the Drivers' Championship race. In 2016 on this day, Jackie Chan would receive an honorary Oscar. And in 2021 on this day, Britney Spears would have her conservatorship ended by a Los Angeles judge after 14 years. What a time. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Moyaha. And on the show today, we are taking a look at Premier results. They gave us an update for their 6 months ended September. We're going to be speaking to the company's CEO. We've also got a chat with the CFO of MultiChoice over their 6 months ended September as well. Looks as though both businesses had interesting time, one better than the other, I suppose. They do operate in different spaces, so we're going to speak to each of the companies and see if we can understand a little bit better about what's been going on. Then we've got a conversation with Jan Vermeulen of My Broadband around the proposal to shut down South Africa's broadband network. Big news. We're going to see what those implications could look like and who suggested this. And then we've got a conversation around the latest labor force survey that suggests that unemployment is down for the first time in a year. We're going to speak to a senior economist at Nedbank around that. And then it's Tuesday. We're going to wrap things up with Property Tuesday this week. We're going to be taking a look at a very interesting tale of a client of a bank that went through some mortgage woes, came out of it to the other side, and hopefully it's a happy ending at the end of the story.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As usual, we start off with how the markets have been moving throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by PSG Old Oaks wealth manager Skulk Lowe to take a look at the market movements and see if we can make sense of them. Good evening, Skulk. I would say it's lovely to speak to you, but the Rand is above 18 Rand.
Man, oh man, what a few days. I mean, they call it the Trump trade. And this Trump trade is just so alive and kicking as we're going along. And unfortunately, we find ourselves in the wrong side of this trade, South Africa. But I want to tell you a story. I mean, you usually start, I love hearing about your history lessons and think, looking back at the past. I want to tell you a story. Can I I have time?
Go for it. Let's go for it, Skulk.
Okay, let's go for it. So this is a individual that made really, he was an individual that was a businessman, a shrewd businessman, and was well known. And he gathered a great following, and then they asked him to run, and he joined the Republican Party. And he had a fantastic election build-up to such an extent that eventually when they went to the polls, there was not even a contest. They won the election by a country mile. He became the president of the country, and markets from the day that was announced, markets just ran. I mean, when I talk about markets, I'm talking about the U.S. markets ran like a house on fire. Now it sounds familiar, and I want to say this is going to history going to be repeated itself. But this individual I'm talking about is an individual called Herbert Hoover, and he was, you know, chosen as the 31st president of the United States back in 1928-29. And why this is important, and I want to tell the listeners this is a little valuable lesson. It's not that I say history is going to repeat itself, because what followed the appointment of this 31st president of the United States, what was the start of the Great Depression. I mean, we saw markets actually to this date. It's called the Great Crash. I mean, it was one of the biggest crashes we've seen in the history of markets, followed by the Great Depression. And although, you know, it sounds like I want to get to a point where I say history is going to repeat itself, all that I want to do is tell listeners, be very, very careful. Very, very careful, you know, following the herd in this circumstance. But because markets are, you know, according to all, you know, big investment houses, you know, the U.S. market is extremely elevated. And now with the appointment of Trump, call it the Trump trade, we do see a massive, massive influx in, again, these tech companies, the S&P 500. Markets are running, and I don't know if it's a market that's really sane currently.
Interestingly enough, Skulk, you bring that up, and that took place, as you said, in 1928 on the 6th of November. On that very, very same day, there were seven other presidents that were elected into office on the 6th of November throughout history in the U.S. Herbert Hoover was just one of them, and five of those seven were Republicans. I put that up on Twitter the day it happened and the day we got confirmed Donald Trump was a president. So, yes, we could be in for another 1928, 1929 repeat. We don't know whether or not that is going to be the case. I think I'd like to think, though, Skulk, that markets are better informed right now, more accustomed to things, and I'm hoping we've learned from our lessons. But anything can happen, right?
Yeah, definitely. And if we haven't learned, we've now got AI to think for us. So, I mean, at least we've got some you know, advantages that the individuals in 1928 didn't have. But all I'm saying is just be very, very careful. I think markets, this type of markets, I do feel, you know, you started off this conversation, look at South Africa. We look at the JSE again, down a further 0.7%. We're looking at the resources. I mean, 3.6% down for today. I mean, this is just a market that's been crazy. I mean, September, we sat here 2 days after the first interest rate hike, and we were talking about, man, this could be good. This could be good for emerging markets. This could be good for South Africa. Here we're sitting, not even 2 months later. We had one individual been brought into a very strong individual for that matter, but we do see a market that's currently, I think, is maybe a little bit, I use the word insane, but just not as sane as it used to be. But be that as it may, I mean, we still need to see, you know, what is, you know, all the policies. We know he made a massive amount of promises, and let's see if he can bring at least half of those promises into fruition.
I definitely agree with you, Skulk. Markets are exceptionally erratic. There's a lot of behavior that is unexplained in the markets, and I'm looking at some of the things. It doesn't really matter where you look. You look at the run that cryptos are going on at the moment. You look at what's happening on the gold side of things. You look at any real market that trades throughout a trading day. Nothing seems to make sense, and that has us worried to say, is this because one, bigger companies or bigger providers are emptying out their risk and taking risk off the table ahead of December? Or is there something that markets are concerned about? I guess we'll never really know, but we can prepare. As you said, Skulk, we can approach it with caution. We can look at things very carefully. And I want to look at some of the developments locally. We see platinum and palladium pricing on the commodity side of it very, very soft from where we were pre a Trump presidency. A lot of that has to do with the Trump announcement, obviously, but a lot of that also has to do with China coming out, and that big stimulus we thought was going to help the market is not really helping the market. It's more aimed at Chinese municipalities. How do we make sense of just the developments outside of the US that are happening in the rest of the world?
Yeah, I think that's extremely good question. I mean, China. We saw them announcing that stimulus literally 2 days after the U.S. reduced the interest rate for the first time. Originally, people were extremely upbeat. You remember? I mean, we had palladium running, platinum running. We even had things like small softer issues, commodities like rubber. Bigger, copper. These commodities ran because people were thinking, "Well, this is it. We were waiting for China to pull out the bazooka. This is it." And it ended up being a bit of a pea shooter, like you mentioned, but. Don't just throw the baby out with the bathwater. I do think we are sitting with a scenario that there's quite a few things that's going to happen. They call it Trump 2.0 for a reason. How does the saying go, Jimmy? It's just, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Now, we had Trump on zero, and they were caught off guard when I said they, China, and to a certain extent also some of these European countries, they were caught off guard to some of these Trump policies, the tariffs, the big word, to the big T, the tariffs. I don't think these countries are going to be as unprepared as they were in 2016, 2017. But as you mentioned, we are up for it. It's going to happen. 2025, I think now has just turned out to be a year which we're going to be it's going to be a big year.
2025 is going to be a big year. Skulk, you and I are going to sit down before the end of 2024 or as 2025 starts, and we're going to see what we anticipate for that year. For now, we're going to leave the conversation there. Take Skulk's warning, heed the warning in the markets, approach the markets with caution. Nothing really makes sense. We'll leave the conversation there. Skulk, thanks as always for the time. Lovely chatting to you. Skulk Lowe, wealth manager at PSG Old Oak, joining me to take a look at some of the sentiment driving markets at the moment and caution around being in the markets.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The consumer staples sector is powered by brands we know and love. We use them every day, and many of them hold fond memories. But do they make good long-term investments? Tune into the SAFM Market Update tomorrow evening at 6:45 as Alan Gray Portfolio Manager Kamal Govan joins me to explore the businesses behind consumer staples, their performance, and the role that these stocks can play in a balanced portfolio. Brought to you by Alan Gray. Long-term investing. Alan Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Exactly 6 months ago, to the very day, actually, on the 12th of June, we spoke to MultiChoice around their full year results. It is now the 12th of November. They have reported today at lunchtime their half year results for the first half of the new financial year, ended September 2024. I'm once again joined by the company's chief financial officer, Tim Jacobs, to take a look at the performance of MultiChoice over the first 6 months of the new year. Good evening, Tim. Thanks so much for taking the time. Lovely to catch up with you again. We looked at last year's results. We closed off last year. We've started off the new year. It's been a tough start to the new year. How are you reflecting on the first 6 months?
Hi there, Jimmy, and hello to your listeners. Look, I think we have to acknowledge that the first 6 months was really tough for us, in particular on two levels. One is subscriber numbers, where we saw the weakness of the second half of last year continuing into the first half of this year. The good news is that we have started to see a little bit of green shoots coming through. So, for example, in the South African business, we saw the premium base. If you look at second half of last year to first half of this year, it only declined by 2%. Normally, that decline half on half has been trending between, I'd say, 4 and 6%. So the premium base is actually looking a little bit more stable, which is very exciting. And then the load shedding had a really nice impact. The fact that we didn't have any made a big impact on the mass market, so in other words, the access bouquet. And those subscribers were actually flat period on period. And then if we look at the rest of Africa, it was a challenge of two countries, really, Nigeria and Zambia. Zambia, because of load shedding, they're now up to 20 hours a day of load shedding, so they're in deep crisis. And of course, what we've seen there is more than half of that subscriber base drop off. And Nigeria, of course, as we all know, has been impacted by very high inflation, very high affordability issues, fuel going through the roof, high interest rates. And so they've been under a lot of pressure. And those two countries together accounted for 86% of the entire loss of subscribers in the rest of Africa. The rest of the countries were actually not too bad. And so that was the one side, right? The part that we were a little bit disappointed with. But as we said at the end of last financial year, what we were focused on this time round was about profitability. And what we were very pleased about is that our core business delivered on the back of some really inflationary price increases and a very strong cost-cutting drive. We managed to do a 32% organic increase before the investment in Showmax. And if we take the investment in Showmax into account, which obviously is where consumers are moving towards, that's the future of the business, we invested an incremental 1.6 billion rands into the Showmax business, and that meant that our trading profit was flat year on year, right, at 5 billion rands. And then, of course, we had the negative impact coming from currencies, which impacted us by 2.3 billion rands. Now, again, that was expected because the currencies moved right at the end of last year, and we knew they were going to roll into the first 6 months. So that's why we've been so focused on the cost side of the business and not as much on the growth side of the business.
Tim, when we look at some of the cost numbers, obviously with, as you said, subscribers declining, last year we spoke the business lost about 1.6 million subscribers. This year you said obviously that there were some continued subscriber losses. And when we look at the DStv subscribers overall coming down from 16.7 down to 14.9 million, we kind of have an idea of what's driving that. The Showmax business was, especially Showmax 2.0, when we last spoke about that, was said to be kind of where the bulk of the focus was going to go into in the new year. So far, the business has cost or has added 2.4 billion rand to losses thus far, and we're not really seeing any revenue increases. I mean, revenues have in fact declined from the 700 million down to about 400 million. How is Showmax 2.0 panning out? Is it going as expected?
Yeah, so a couple of things that need to be mentioning. The reason for the decline in revenue was because when we did the deal with Comcast, we had two products that our original Showmax 1.0 was selling. One of them was Showmax Pro, which was a full football offering. And the second one, and that was at a high ARPU. I think we were selling that at about 349 rands a month. And we also had the Diaspora. Both of those products had to be closed down when we did this deal. And so as a consequence, that is the reason that the revenue dropped. It wasn't because the business hasn't performed. The business itself, our paying subscribers, have grown by 30% since we've launched. So that is moving. But we are seeing, very similar to the linear business, the impact in some of our key markets like Nigeria, Zambia, means that some of the take-up in the rest of Africa isn't quite at the levels that we had hoped for. We're also seeing the impact of currencies on this business, right? So the same macro dynamics that we are seeing in the linear business are also impacting here. And what we're busy doing with this business at the moment is we are still building out some of the key enablers. So, for example, in the linear businesses, we've got, you know, a lot of payment options, over 200 payment options. Whereas in the Showmax business, in the first iteration when we went live, I think we only had about 6 or 7 payment options across the continent. So as we build out more of those, as we build out some of the partnerships with some of the mobile operators and some of our other distributor partners, we hopefully are going to see some significant more traction coming through in that business. But we just need to remember that this is an early stage business. And so, you know, these kind of challenges that we're seeing on the operational side are to be expected. We weren't expecting to kind of come out the gates with 100% everything working.
Mm. Tim, can we take a look at the balance sheet? There was a slight kind of technical insolvency towards the end of the financial year with assets being slightly below liabilities. That seems to have widened a bit with assets coming down even more, liabilities staying kind of high. So the business in a bit more of a worse off situation from an insolvency perspective. Obviously, the business still has quite a healthy amount of assets there. What's the plan to turn that around? You touched on the cost cutting side of it earlier and saying that was a focal point for the business. What's the plan to deal with the solvency side of it?
Yeah, that's actually an excellent question. So we finished the half with negative equity of 2.7 billion rands. As you'll remember, we entered into a negotiation with Sanlam to buy 60% of our insurance business. Now, this is a deal that goes back a couple of years now. We've been working on this for some time, and we have 95% confidence that the last CP, which is the Prudential Authority approval, is going to happen imminently. And when that happens, the accounting gain that we get from the sale of that 60% of that business is between 2.6 and 3.3 billion rands. And that in itself will resolve most of that that negative equity position. And then, of course, when we look at the transition to the end of the year, we are expecting to see some significant improvement in the foreign exchange position relative to the first half. So, for example, we're expecting to see smaller losses on cash remittances versus last year, because the parallel and the official rate in Nigeria is relatively narrow. And we've opened up a hedge book for about 18 months now, and that hedge book, if the rand continues to be a little weaker like we're seeing at the moment, then that will lower the impact of that long dated hedge book on the results. So we're fairly confident that we'll be out of the negative equity position in November, and we have every intention to stay that way all the way through to the end of the year.
Mm-hmm. Tim, before I let you go, can you give us an update on the Canal Plus transaction? Obviously, that's got some regulatory hurdles it needs to cross through. What's the latest on the deal? Where are the delays? What's happening there? It's still obviously a very, very big deal that is very important for the MultiChoice Group. Where do we stand?
Absolutely. So, as you'll know, we signed a cooperation agreement with Canal Plus, and so we've been working with them on some of the regulatory submissions, trying to make sure that we get through this as quickly as we can. On the 30th of September, we submitted our application to the South African Competition Commission. And what we're doing at the moment is we're now busy with the applications in some of the other jurisdictions in Africa that also need to have submissions made. So that's the second phase of those ComCom submissions. At the same time, we've been in discussions with our own regulator, ICASA. And those discussions are ongoing. Although we don't think that we need an approval, it is always a good idea to be in discussion with your regulator, making sure that their understanding and your understanding is on the same page. So that's going ongoing at the same time. The only thing that we, of course, caution about is nobody can predict when regulatory approvals and processes will come to a conclusion, unfortunately. And the latest, Vodacom matter is a case in point, where they waited for 4 years. Of course, we don't think that our deal is nearly as complicated as that. It is complicated, but there's no competition, so there's no overlap in our market with Canal Plus, so we're not removing a competitor from the market. So it should go a little bit smoother than what they've seen.
We'll hope and pray that that is the case and that does come around sooner rather than later. We'll catch up as soon as we have more information around that. Thanks for the update, though, Tim. Thanks for keeping us in the loop with how the business is doing. We wish you the best of luck for the rest of the year. That's Tim Jacobs, Chief Financial Officer at MultiChoice, on how they started off their new financial year and how the year is shaping up for them.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
At 8 o'clock this morning, Premier Group gave us an update on how they have been faring. They gave us an update for their interim period for the 6 months ended September 2024. And I'm joined on the line by the company's CEO, Kobus Gertenbach, to take a look at the numbers and see if we can make sense of them. Kobus, good evening. Thanks so much for taking the time. Certainly an interesting set of numbers. How do you reflect on the first half of the new year? I mean, revenues are up, operating profits are up. It seems as very little to be upset about.
Yes, thank you very much for the opportunity. I think we are very satisfied with the results. Trading hasn't been easy. I think the consumer base in all the countries that we operate in Southern Africa in particular, has been under continued pressure. And I think that the 6 billion rand that we've invested in our facilities over the last 13 years to drive efficiencies and economies of scale have continued to benefit us. And, I think that we're exceptionally happy with the way that our factories and our supply chains have really operated efficiently to get products to the market without really having to push through any price increase to our consumers.
Kobus, you joined the business a couple of years ago now, in 2011, and it was just after the 2005 kind of delisting of Premier Group. You're now listed back on the exchange. How has that kind of transition coming back into the listed space? Is it kind of like riding a bike? Are you finding that it's different operating the entity now, given that you're CEO versus where you were when you joined the business?
Well, I think that when I joined as the CFO initially in 2011, and obviously that was after the business had been delisted previously. And I guess, you know, we were quite fortunate that during this period of time, we had a opportunity to make significant improvements in the business while we were out of the public eye. And, you know, since we've been back on the market last year, March, I think the hardest part is really the preparation work towards actually getting the listing away. But I find that once we've been operating in the listed markets, you know, it's really around investments and so forth. But from a pure operational perspective, we've managed to continue to run our business irrespective of whether we are exposed to public markets or not.
Mm. Kobus, you touched on being able to clean up the business when being out of the public eye, but even in the public eye now, debt repayments are down 18.2% on the interest side of things, and that's as a result of paying down some of that debt. Take me through just how the balance sheet is shaping up at the moment. It looks as though some strategic decisions are starting to pay off for the business.
Well, I think that when we initially came to market, we were around about I think north of 1.5 times EBITDA of debt on our balance sheet. And we always wanted to be around the 1 times EBITDA. So we knew we had work to do when we came to market last year. And I think that the cash generation of the business allowed us to make quite a significant repayment at the end of December last year that that brought our debt levels down to exactly where we wanted. And I think that with our current debt facilities that we've just refinanced with our financial providers in the last month, we've managed to reset our debt for the next 4 years, and we've managed to get rates from the financial markets that are very favorable. And I think it's testament to the fact that the debt levels are now right where it's really just an efficient capital structure and doesn't pose any risk to the banks that are providing the loans.
Kobus, let's take a look at the business's operational plans. I remember there was an announcement around 1.2 billion rands worth of capex to be set aside for the 2024-25 financial years, split across both of those years, with obviously some conversations around potentially acquiring a couple of businesses in the UK and Mozambique. Take me through what's happening on the capex side, but also what's happening with the acquisitions and the strategy at the moment.
Yes, I mean, we've signaled that we're going to spend 700 million rand on capex this year and another 700 million next year as we continue to build out our new bakery in Aeroton in the southern part of Johannesburg for the inland market. It is a massive project for us. It's going to take us about 2.5 years to complete, and we're really hoping to get it online in the second half of next year, next calendar year. But then over and above that, we also got the opportunity to invest in the Gold Keys International, which is a family-owned business that in the rice category. And we paid away just over 300 million rand for a 30% interest in that business earlier this year as well. But that has rounded out our staple offering, where a lot of our large competitors had rice within the categories as well, and we did. And it's now really enabled us to compete on all fronts. So the capital program will continue. The next financial year, as I said, is another 700 million rand spend as we look to finish the bakery projects that we've started.
I remember those bakery projects being so essential when you and I caught up in November of last year. Pretty much this time last year, we spoke about the importance of those bakery businesses adding towards the business. Kobus, I want to look at the rest of the business, the grocery side of it, the international business. What's the outlook? Do you have any business areas at the moment that are giving you a bit of a headache, or are you kind of seeing a bit of a slow, steady kind of progress within all of the units and you're satisfied with the way things are going at the moment?
Well, I think we're very happy with our kind of sugar confectionery business that trades under the Manhattan and Mr. Sweet brands. You know, that business, we've made some substantial investments there as well. We're busy commissioning a new licorice facility there too. So I think we're very happy with the progress on that. Our Lillet's and Dove home and personal care business has also performed very well, and very happy with the progress there. I think our real hotspot at the moment, though, is our Mozambican business. Things things have just really macroeconomically been quite tough within the Mozambican market, and especially now since the election has resulted in some political volatility within the country. We just hope that that you know a peaceful solution can be brokered there, and that it doesn't erupt into further political violence within the country. We've been very focused on making sure that our people are safe, that our facilities are kept safe. And so we've had numerous days, especially over the last 2 weeks, where we either couldn't produce anything or we couldn't distribute any of our product into the market. So we're watching that hour by hour, day by day, and hopefully we can get a peaceful conclusion there to take things forward in that country.
Kobus, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the dividends side of things. The business obviously has a dividend policy in place of that 30 to 60% of diluted HEPS. There was nothing around interim dividends here, but by all accounts, we can assume that if all things stay the same, we could have a good full year dividend. Is that something that management has kind of looked at to say everything is on track at the moment?
Yes, I think we've always signaled to the market as we came to market last year that we're going to pay our maiden dividend this year. We did that in August. And so we will also, as you say, between 30 and 60% of our HEPS will pay out as a dividend next year on the back of our full year numbers. And we're certainly on track to do that. We will continue to reevaluate our policy in the future and see whether it's worth it for us to consider interim dividend. But we don't feel it's necessary at this point in time.
Well, we wish you all the best of luck with the second half of the year. Hopefully some exciting acquisitions coming through that we can reflect on and talk about as they come to light. But we'll catch up certainly as the year progresses. That was Kobus Gertenbach, who is the CEO of Premier Group, joining me to reflect on how the first half of their new financial year has kicked off and what they're looking forward to for the rest of the year.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And we are taking a look at the developments from the Portfolio Committee in Government. There was a recent comment around the, or rather comment made by the Portfolio Committee that we should possibly look at the broadband situation in South Africa and changing how that is looked at the moment. I'm joined on the line by the editor at My Broadband, Jan Vermeulen, to take a look at this. Good evening, Jan. Lovely to catch up with you. Lovely to speak to you. The latest developments from the Portfolio Committee on Communications, what is it that they want to do and why do they want to do it?
Yeah, so there's a lot of stuff coming out of the Portfolio Committee on Communications recently. There's the SABC drama and now this situation around broadband InfraCo. So this is something that dates back years and several ministers. This is a proposal that was still made under Stella Ndabeni Abrams. She wanted to integrate broadband InfraCo and Sentech, essentially, wanted to merge the two entities. And there was some progress made under her successors, but now the department made a presentation in front of the Portfolio Committee and essentially said that Broadband InfraCo is insolvent. It's technically insolvent. Its liquidity ratio is below one, and so it doesn't actually pass the conditions that government requires for one state-owned enterprise to acquire another one. They said that the fastest way to establish this state digital infrastructure company was essentially what this whole process was about, was merging Sentech and Broadband InfraCo into one SDIC. And they said the fastest way to have done this would be for Sentech to buy Broadband InfraCo. But that's off the table, because Broadband InfraCo is technically insolvent. So and so the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee has actually gone so far as to recommend that the minister, or rather that the Department of Communications, quote and unquote, de-establish Broadband InfraCo, which is really just a way of saying shut it down and transfer its assets to someone else like CENTEC. So yeah, that's a pretty damning statement coming out of the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee about the future prospects of broadband InfraCo.
Jan, the last time they looked at this, the last time this was explored and the financial feasibility was done, as you mentioned, obviously the solvency side of it was an issue, but it was also concluded by the same portfolio committee, or maybe different members of the committee, that it would prove to be financially difficult for both entities. Are we not just creating a bigger problem here by having this, whether it's the de-establishment or the takeover or whatever it is? Should we not be looking at an alternative solution rather than stripping off some good assets, throwing away a couple of things, and hopefully coming out of it with a win?
Yeah, and you know, this is going to sound extreme, but government has proven time and again that it cannot run a telecommunications network. It is simply incapable. It can't build them, it can't maintain them, it can't operate them, it can't sell. It's just something that doesn't seem to be in our government's DNA. And so it's actually better to just farm that out to someone who can. And right now, that's the private sector. And I know it's a swear word in government to talk about privatization. But you know who essentially used to run Broadband InfraCo's assets was Neotel, which is now Liquid Intelligent Technologies. Now, they have their whole own set of drama to deal with right now. So I'm not proposing that the assets go back to Liquid. But something like that, where a private entity essentially operates this network under some kind of license. Can you imagine the bun fight? When Neotel was just being established as a competitor to Telkom, it was kind of like a no-brainer to say, oh, all this dark fiber assets, you know, that belong to Transnet and Eskom and everybody else, let's collect all that and give it to the second network operator so that they can better compete against Telkom. But if you try and do that today, you're going to have the most acrimonious fight on your hands that you've ever seen, because now the fiber industry is vibrant and competitive. And if you just think you're going to hand over government assets to a private player for nothing, then you're going to have a few dozen people sticking up their hands and going, hey, why does Telkom get it? Which is a partly state-owned enterprise, in fairness, but why does Telkom get it? Why is Dark Fiber Africa getting it? Why is Frogfoot getting it? You know, why not me? Why not, you know, me, a little FNO, you know, at the very bottom of the pyramid? Why am I not getting this asset to manage and get a free ride by letting people lease it from me? And so, yeah, it's all I'm trying to say is now it's a complex situation. Perhaps the government's best bet here is just to sell it to the highest bidder.
Well, that's it. You can open up an auction process. You can open up a bidding process. But we have seen in the past that when you do kind of open things up a little bit more in certain spaces, Telkom, a prime example of that, you can achieve a public-private partnership that does benefit everybody and keeps things alive in the way that it should. Jan, before I let you go, I want to look at the benefits of the SDIC, or the benefits of keeping InfraCo, or even if the benefits of merging with CENTEC. What would we be looking to gain from all of this at the end of the day by establishing this SDIC?
Yeah, so if I'm steelmanning the other side, because honestly, I don't think there is an upside here. This is shuffling the deck chairs on the Titanic. Steelmanning the other side for just a second, I think the idea was to gain some kind of economy of scale, to share expertise and resources amongst government departments that are sorely lacking for skills, because the skills that they need to do what they want to do are being lapped up by the private sector, who are also struggling for skills, right? Like, everybody is fighting furiously over the technical skills needed to do this kind of job. I guess the idea there was to kind of amalgamate two infrastructure businesses that were complementary, was the high-level strategic thinking here. CENTEC is wireless. CENTEC does the signal distribution for the SABC and ETV and the old MNET channel, which I think has been shut down now, and the digital TV signal and so on. and broadband InfraCo is purely fiber, right? There's no overlap between the two. But that's precisely the problem, is while they're both networking companies, wireless and wireline are two different worlds. Like, you might be able to translate some of, like, the you know, internet protocol skills and stuff between the two, and like general principles between the two, but the actual workings of those two types of businesses is incredibly different. And so that's why I'm going, you know, just even at a high level, this concept of merging the two entities was dumb from the beginning. And honestly, at this point, government will be getting better value for money by selling broadband InfraCo rather than trying to rather than having that infrastructure languish, because that's not part of the problem that the committee highlighted, was this infrastructure is falling into disrepair, and when it's completely become useless, then the asset will be worth nothing. So while it's worth something, sell it and get something for it and have it benefit the South African people.
Interestingly enough, the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on Communications had some reservations as well about this SDIC proceeding. We'll leave the conversation there, Jan. Thanks as always for the time and for the insights. Lovely chatting to you. Jan van Meulen, editor at My Broadband, on the proposal that is sitting with the Portfolio Committee on Communications to merge two SOEs into one, and whether or not we should be doing that.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, for something involving both public and private sectors, business and governments are coming together to build South Africa. Just take a listen to how this is happening.
Adrian Gall, CEO of Discovery. I'm very supportive of the pledge. The pledge is about a belief in the potential of the country. I think we all unequivocally believe it. The pledge has actually led to a partnership. The partnership has led to the end of load shedding, working with government and other very powerful things that we're doing. This is an important phase in the country. We're at a point of inflection. We really have to get economic growth. And we've got a pretty clear, focused bunch of areas we know we have to do. So the pledge is part of that process of making sure we get economic growth. Economic growth drives jobs. Jobs drives people feeling better sentiment, and they invest, and that drives growth. So the pledge is about turning this virtuous cycle of growth, jobs, narrative, and that changes the country. So there's an amazing chemistry with South Africans. You know, if we're focused and we get things done, we make massive change. And I've felt that in the partnership. So this is phase two. We're in a better state now than we were. It's amazing what we can do.
To learn more about this impactful commitment to South Africa's future, visit business4sa.org. That's business4sa, as in the word for, .org. According to Stats SA, the quarterly labor force survey suggests that unemployment has decreased over the third quarter. I'm joined on the line by Isaac Machego, who is the senior economist at Nedbank, to take a look at this and see if we can make sense of it. Good evening, Isaac. Thanks so much for taking the time. Unemployment down by 1.4%. What's been driving this?
Good evening, Jimmy. A bit of an encouraging trend, but it's still the early days to celebrate. I mean, we've seen key sectors such as mining recovering some of the job losses. We've seen jobs going up this quarter by just over 27,000, but we're coming out of a very difficult 2023 when there were, you know, widespread job losses in the sector. And also construction has shown some life after several quarters of job losses. But overall, I would say that, you know, we still have a lot to do, because when you look at today's number, without 160,000 people leaving the job market, i.e. or at least stopping to actively look for jobs, the so-called discouraged workers, without that 160,000, the unemployment rate would be about half a percentage point higher.
So we're saying that we didn't actually create more jobs, there were just less people looking for jobs?
No, on an net basis, there were more jobs created, as 294,000 jobs created, but 160,000 people. We're not actively looking for jobs. So, you know, those will be kind of classified rather as the discouraged workers. So they don't really count in the unemployment rates because they're not actively looking for jobs right now.
Mm. Isaac, is this a sustainable trend that we can expect to benefit from? I mean, I heard you say a little earlier that it's too soon to celebrate. We still have much work to do. Is this something that we can expect will continue going forward?
Sure. You know, what we've seen this year is the stabilization of the economy. We can start with sentiment after, you know, the election outcome, you know, a government that is considered to be a lot more stable and policy that's more certain than was feared before the elections, and also in the supply of utilities, for instance. We've seen stabilization in the electricity grid, and even the utility sector did create jobs during this past quarter. So that shows, you know, the improvement in that sector. So we've seen stabilization this year, and what I expect is with the improved sentiment this year and the more stable operating environment, I expect that to translate into a better operating environment in 2025, at least from 2025, and that could boost investment, particularly by the private sector, and lead to more job creation.
Isaac, quickly before I let you go, what of youth unemployment?
That, you know, remains a huge problem. Unfortunately, it is structural. What do we mean by that? You know, our economy at the moment has a very low capacity to absorb the youth that are entering the labor market. And that's a very important point because, you know, this is year end. In the first quarter of the year, you know, we often see on average between 300,000 and 400,000 new people entering the job market, most of whom come straight out of the education system. And that is a problem because we need an economy that can start creating jobs at a higher level for these new entrants. Otherwise, our youth unemployment rate is going to remain elevated above the reported 55% or so.
We need an economy that creates jobs at a higher level. I'll take that as the parting thought from Isaac. That's Isaac Mashego, who is the senior economist at Nedbank, joining us to reflect on the latest labor force survey that suggests that unemployment has come down.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's Property Tuesday, and I thought for this one, let's try something different. There was an interesting matter that involved a bank and a home loan owner where the home loan owner took the bank to court on several occasions because the bank tried to have her evicted from her home. There's lots to unpack around this matter. I'm joined on the line by MoneyWeb's contributor, Kieran Ryan, to take a look at this matter and see if we can make sense of it. Good evening, Kieran. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with a bit of a background around this particular matter. Why did we get this far into it? What happened here?
Yeah, it's not an uncommon case. This is a case of a lady by the name of Patience Mavusa, who had fallen into arrears like a lot of people do on their mortgage bonds. Remember, if you've got a 20-year mortgage bond, it's an actuarial certainty that at some point you'll hit a financial speed wobble. So she ran into trouble, fell into arrears, and then, of course, the whole process starts, the legal recovery process, and the first thing they do is they send you, you know, a couple of warnings, catch up. Then you get a Section 129 notice in terms of the National Credit Act. If you don't catch up with your arrears, we're going to court. And this is, in fact, what happened. And FNB took her to court because of the arrears. What had happened in the meantime is that she'd actually caught up on her arrears. Remember, this process can take several months. So she speedily got some funds together. She caught up on her arrears. But the bank went ahead anyway and got judgment against her. So with that judgment in hand, they then proceeded to sell the property at auction, which is done through the sheriff's auctions. Now, a bit of background here. There is a very important landmark case called Inkatha versus FNB. The very same bank that's involved in Patience Mavusa's case was also involved in this Constitutional Court judgment. What that judgment says is that if you have fallen into arrears and you catch up on the arrears and you pay reasonable legal costs of the case, then your mortgage bond is reinstated. When your mortgage bond is reinstated, it freezes any legal action that can be taken by the bank. But that didn't happen in this case. So the transfer of the property went ahead. She had the property sold despite the fact that she caught up with her arrears. And then the new buyer who picked up this thing at auction for a great bargain, he started arriving at the door and trying to evict her. And she was staying in a complex, an apartment complex, and the people who, the managers of the complex, actually revoked her access to it. So she spent 3 years trying to fight this and trying to get this reversed, which she eventually did, because the Encarta case that I just mentioned makes it very clear. Her mortgage bond was reinstated because she paid her arrears. The bank did eventually concede that it made a mistake. But in the meantime, you know, there was a whole lot of court action and legal fees that she incurred to get to that point. What she had to do was she had to bring an application, two applications before the court, just to get the buyer's contact details. Neither the bank nor the buyer would provide that information to her. She had to go to court twice to get that information. And then she gave notice of her intention to fight this thing in the court. She was going to oppose the transfer of her property. FNB disclosed that it would oppose that. Why it would do that is pretty unclear. FNB has subsequently responded to this article saying that there was at the time they were doing, you know, manual surveillance of the this whole thing about reinstatement of mortgage bonds. So they missed this one, and they corrected it when they did find out. So I guess a modicum of credit is due to FNB in that regard. But why it went on this long, and this is, by the way, just the tip of the iceberg. There are so many people going through instances like this where their homes are being repossessed and sold from underneath them, and they're being evicted despite the fact that they have caught up on arrears and therefore their mortgage bonds have been reinstated. And this should not be happening.
I was just going to say, Kieran, this is quite an interesting thing that it's not the first time this has happened for this particular bank, but it's also not the first time we've heard of these sorts of cases happening for consumers. Is there kind of an established process that consumers can follow? I mean, one would think that the banks and other financial institutions or financial lenders are there to be on the side of the consumer. But when you start to read more and more of these cases, it doesn't seem that way all the time.
Well, I think the banks will tell you that they are on the side of the consumers and they're trying to help them when they run into trouble. And I suppose to some extent that is true. I mean, there are instances, for example, during COVID, you know, you got a 3-month repayment holiday on your mortgage loans, that kind of thing. But in essence, what is happening with this whole legal process? Once you're on the legal train, your Section 129 notice has been served on you, and that's basically an ultimatum: pay up or we're going to court. Once that's in train, they've outsourced all of that to these law firms. And these law firms are very enthusiastic about continuing and perpetuating these cases. So what I think, and I've discussed this with various lawyers who are obviously not representing the banks, what's needed is something like a very specific ombud. Not really an ombud, because an ombud in today's terms, they really act like postmen. They'll send a complaint to the bank and they'll get a response. And sometimes they never really mediate very much. The bank either agrees or they don't. What you need is like a specialized court with very, very specific advocates and maybe retired judges and people who understand consumer law and who understand banking law. Because one of the things that is also happening is people are finding that their mortgage repayments are increasing wherever there's a legal involvement. So they start, you know, send you a legal letter. Well, that's going to cost them. And that goes onto your mortgage bond as well. Anytime you're a day or two late, you know, you start finding these fees and you're just mounting up. So even though you paid the arrears, you're finding that you haven't settled the full amount that the bank is claiming. And that's because they're adding these legal fees. Well, there's a problem with that too. And this is made clear in the same Encarta judgment from the Constitutional Court.
We're going to have to leave the conversation there. Thank you so much, Kieran, for those insights. That's Kieran Ryan, contributor at MoneyWeb, joining us to take a look at the latest developments in a unique property case. It's just gone 7 o'clock. Greg Host is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.